Hey everyone, welcome back to the Power Hour podcast, to part one of my conversation with John McAvoy. I really, really enjoyed hearing John's incredible story. There were moments in this interview when I held my breath. There were moments when I had tears in my eyes. And I really think that everyone will take something away from this conversation. So I hope you enjoy listening as much as I did. Let's dive in to part one with John McAvoy.
Welcome to the Power Hour. I'm Adrienne Herbert, wellness coach, international speaker, and author. Each week, I speak to a variety of guests, from business founders to Olympic athletes, leading coaches, change makers, and innovators, to find out their daily habits, their rules to live by, and what motivates them to get up out of bed each day. Personally, I am on a mission to encourage, motivate, and inspire, so I hope that the Power Hour will help you to achieve your personal and professional goals.
John McAvoy, welcome to the Power Hour podcast. Thank you so, so much for joining us.
Thank you for asking me to come on. I'm really excited about having a conversation with you.
Oh, me too. And honestly, where to begin? John, your story is truly remarkable. In fact, some parts of it are actually unbelievable. I know a lot about your story, and every time I read something else or I listen to you in another interview, I learn something new. And today I'd like to talk to you about choice, identity, moments in our life that define us, willpower, self-discipline, and ultimately how sport has transformed your entire life. So I think a good place to start, my first question for you, is one that I think is important for listeners of the show to understand more about you and how your journey started. And that question is, when you were a young boy at school, what was your life like and how would you describe yourself then?
So when I was little, I was very hyperactive. I had a lot of energy. I grew up in a really loving home. My mum is an amazing woman. She's had a big Irish family. So my mum had seven sisters and one brother. So when I was growing up, I was just doted on by all of these women. And I had my sister as well. And I just had these really fun memories of Christmases, spending them with my granddad, my aunties, on my mum's side of the family. And when I started going to primary school, it was only then I had the realization I didn't have a dad, because children being children, people used to tease me at primary school for not having a dad, because people used to ask me where my dad was and I didn't have a dad at home. And I asked my mum where my dad was, and my mum explained to me that my dad had passed away before I was born. And he went to bed next to my mum. He was 38 years old. My mum was 8 months pregnant with me. They had only been married for a year, and he went to bed next to her, and he passed away and had a massive heart attack. He had an undiagnosed heart condition. So my mum explained this to me when I was really young, and that really had a huge, huge impact over me as a child, because I then realised that I wasn't going to live forever, and I was too young to really understand all this. Like, when I asked my mum where my dad had gone, and my mum sort of simplified it and said my dad had gone to heaven. But I understood that you don't live forever from a very young age. Mm-hmm. And this event lit something up inside of me that when I was older, I didn't want to be normal and average. And I wanted to achieve something with my life. I wanted my life to have meaning. And as sort of I got a little bit older, and I was still quite young, I was only like 7 or 8, I just had this passion for history. And my mum used to take me to like the HMS Belfast in London and the War Museum. And she used to buy me like books and magazines and take me to the library. And there was a set of magazines, and this is like in the 1980s, they were called Discovery Booklets. And they used to come out every month. And they were like for children, and they were like different stages of history. And I remember putting these booklets together, like these puzzles in these children's history magazines, and just reading about men and women that had lived hundreds of years before me, and they had achieved something with their lives, where like I was sitting in our flat in Crystal Palace Park Road reading about them. And then this then really ignited something about legacy. Mm-hmm. And again, I was too young to understand what that word meant, but I wanted to achieve something in my life. Like, I wanted to be remembered.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's incredibly young, as you described, you know, 8 years old, to have that realization about mortality and to think, okay, yeah, I want to achieve something in my life. I don't want to, as you know, you use the word meaningful. And, you know, at that age, who did you then, I suppose, look to? Who did you idolize? You know, I've got a young son and I see him and his friends and the people that they idolize, whether it's footballers or WWE wrestlers or YouTubers or presidents, you know, who did you, I suppose, when you said you wanted to be known, you wanted a legacy, who were you looking to then for that kind of inspiration?
Do you know something? It's quite weird, actually, because when I was growing up, like, I never really had that. Like, I had no interest in sport whatsoever, like, literally none. Like, I would go to a football game every now and again, but I was really bad at sport when I was at school. So I had no, like, passion for it whatsoever. But what I did, it wasn't necessarily a person, it was a thing. And I was sort of, this passion got lit up inside me with British Telecom. Being a young kid in the 1980s, where British Telecom had this monopoly over the telephone communication system in the UK, and everyone had BT landlines in their house, and there was a BT phone box at the end of the road, and there used to be these BT adverts on the television. And that inspired me as a child. Like, when I was older, I wanted to own British Telecom. And I remember I asked my Uncle Tony when I was little, yeah, how much money British Telecom made. And he said they make billions of pounds. And that was what inspired me as a child. And that was what my dream was. When I was a young kid, it was when I got older, I wanted to own British Telecom. And I can remember, like, people used to ask me, and I used to say, well, that's what I want to do when I'm older. And again, I had this drive to achieve something. But what I did from a young age, again, I connected success up to wealth and the acquisition of acquiring wealth, which obviously later on in my life was very detrimental.
Yeah, well, where did that drive for, you mentioned, you know, wanting to be a billionaire, wanting to earn a lot of money, that drive for wealth, where did that ultimately, I suppose, lead you to?
Well, this is when, like, a person did come into my life, and that was my mum's ex-husband, Billy. And he came into our lives when I was 8 years old. My mum had married him when she was 16 years old. They literally grew up together as children. She got married to him at 16. She fell pregnant with my sister when she was 18. And then they end up getting divorced. And then years later, my mum met my dad. And then I was sort of born and my dad died. And then when I was 8 years old, Billy come into our lives. And very few men ever come into our home other than my uncles. So one day this man turns up, jet black hair, big gold watch on his wrist, immaculately dressed. I remember he had really shiny shoes, and he come into our home, and I was just in awe of him. From the first moment I saw him, I was just magnetized to him. And he went into the living room and he sat down with my mum and my sister, and he asked me to go and make him a hot drink, a cup of tea. And I went into the kitchen and I made him his cup of tea, and I went back into the living room and I gave it to him. And I was sitting there and he was talking to my mum, and again, I was too young to really understand what was going on. And then after about an hour or so, he got up and left. And as he was walking out the front door, he patted me on the head and he said, "You're a good boy." And he gave me a £20 note. And it was the first time a grown adult had ever given me paper money. And I was just like, wow, like, I've never been given a £20 note before. And obviously, as a child, the first thing I'm thinking about is going to Woolworths and buying some sweets from the Pick and Mix. And when he left, we went back into the living room and I asked my mum who he was. And my mum explained that when she was really young, she was married to him before she married to my dad. And my sister was actually my half-sister, and that was her dad. And again, I was a little bit confused because I didn't really understand what all that meant. And anyway, as the weeks progressed, he used to come round and he would take my sister out. And then he asked my mum if I could go. And my mum agreed, because I think my mum didn't want me to miss out on an opportunity to go and do something nice. So as the weeks went on and on and on, he'd come around every Saturday, pick my sister up. And eventually it got to a point where he stopped taking my sister out and he continued taking me out. And he completely opened up this different world to me. Like at the time, my mum was a florist. She didn't really have much money. Like she wasn't struggling, but she just didn't have a lot. But she did everything she could to make sure me and my sister had a really good childhood and we had everything we needed. But Billy had this obscene amount of wealth that I could see as a kid. Like he had a Mercedes Benz, everything revolved around money. And when he would take me out to restaurants, I was quite a shy child. And I always used to like hide behind my mum a little bit and behind my sister. And I didn't really have much confidence. And he would take me to restaurants and he'd make me sit down and he would make me order my own food. And as I got a little bit older, I sort of started realizing that people treated him a lot different to other people. They respected him. They treated him completely different. Like if we went into a restaurant or a bar or a clothes shop, the treatment he got compared to other people was so different. And it was only when my granddad passed away, when I was about 11 years old, 12, we went to go and clear my granddad's flat out. And my granddad had this massive envelope in a drawer. And in the envelope was all these newspaper clippings from all the tabloid press in the UK, The Sun, The Mirror. And there was Billy on the front pages of all these clippings that my granddad had kept. And it transpired that Billy was one of the most prolific armed robbers in the United Kingdom. He had 5 acquittals at the Old Bailey. He was a multi-millionaire when he was 21 years old, which he never used to stop telling me about. But he never used to tell me that what he used to do. So I just thought he had lots of money. But when I read these newspaper clippings, I kind of started connecting up all the dots. And all of these men that he was exposing me to as a kid, I kind of realized then they were probably all doing the same thing as what he had done and what he was probably doing then when I was with him. And then I started getting more inquisitive when I was with him and I was asking him questions. And he was always very guarded around stuff. And then when I was about 13, there was a film on Channel 3. It was called Fool's Gold. And my real dad that died, his brother Michael, committed the biggest armed robbery in the world. And I sat down and watched this film where Sean Bean was playing my uncle in a Hollywood film. And I saw that Sean Bean was sitting on £26 million worth of gold bullion in this Hollywood film. And I feel embarrassed today to say it, but that film inspired me then to become a criminal. Because what had happened was when I was sort of around all these older people that had a complete disregard for the law, like complete disregard. And when you're a young man and you're searching for being successful and you're searching for your meaning in life and you want to do something and you are ambitious and you want to achieve something, I then saw an obtainable path to travel down where I could reach that goal of acquiring that wealth. And you're around these men that think like that in regards of they've got no respect for the law or they do what they want when they want. And as a young person, especially as a male, that's very exciting and you can get quite easily drawn into that. And then when that world and that lifestyle is becoming quite sort of accessible and encouraged, that was when I made the decision that is what I was going to do when I was older.
So yeah, because I guess as you're describing then, all of those influences, you know, you describe, you know, looking up to him and going out with him and having a good time, and then, you know, it's quite glamorized, you know, even finding, you know, newspaper covers or watching a film which is about, you know, your dad's brother, and like you said, it does seem, if you're young, I suppose that kind of the power side of it or the excitement part or the kind of the glamorization of the, you know, the crime scenes and all the rest of it. But did you, I guess at that time, did you feel any sense of, I don't know, fear, or was there any kind of moral compass thinking, oh, this could be, or were you just, I guess, just drawn into it?
Yeah, like, no, because in regards of when you sort of are growing up in that environment, and again, a lot of it was subconscious to me when I was a kid, because obviously I knew they wasn't the same as everyone else. I knew my stepdad got treated differently to everyone else, but I didn't know what they did. But as you're sort of in that environment, that world becomes so normalized to you as a young person that that is your world. You don't see anything outside of that. So then the fear part of it and the moral compass part of it wouldn't be the same as if someone didn't get involved that as a child and probably later on in life got off the opportunity to commit a criminal offence. And they go, I'm not doing that. Like, I'll go to prison for 20 years. But when you're growing up in that environment as a child, that's just normal. Like, your uncle being in prison for 25 years for committing the biggest armed robbery in the world, your stepdad having 5 acquittals at the Old Bailey. And then when I saw him when I was 8 years old, he just got released after doing 16 years. And all of these men that I was being exposed to, as I started having an awareness of what they were doing, you realise that, like, you're hearing these stories of them in and out of prison, getting arrested all the time. You're hearing stories of people getting shot. And you're a young person, like, you're exposed to it, and it just becomes normal. It becomes completely normal to you. And that's what you think life is. And I've said this before, and I said it in my book, like, there was a part when I was 12 years old where my stepdad had this Porsche 911, and there was only a couple of hundred of them in the UK. It was, like, supercharged up. It was top of the range Porsche. And I remember we were driving down a high street near Bromley, and I was in the passenger seat, and he told me to look out the window when we stopped at a set of traffic lights. And I said, what do you mean? He said, look out the window. And people walking about, going shopping, doing their thing. And he was like, these people are all sheep. And he said, basically, the system, like, does something rude to them, and we do something rude back to the system. The system doesn't do that to us. And that was really powerful. Like, to say that to a 12-year-old kid, that the system's corrupt and the system basically exploits the working people and we exploit the system. And again, that behaviour then started to really manifest itself into my mindset and the way I saw the world. And then when I went to school, that was where I completely gave up my education, because to me, the education system, my teachers become an extension of the state. And I was really rude and disrespectful to my teachers. I started truanting a lot. And what was happening, it was the projection of the view of the world from these older people onto me. And then I was going to school, and then I was acting that out in school, because I remember I used to have a really lovely English teacher. And I feel bad now, like, the way I was so rude to her in my lessons, because she used to do everything she could to, like, keep me engaged with education, because my teachers knew what my home life was like, because some of my family were in the national newspapers and there was films made. So my teachers had an awareness. Again, I didn't realise this at the time. It's only when I look back. But really, they should have excluded me from school years and years and years before that, before I even got to the point when I was 16 years old. Because I was so rude and disrespectful, but they didn't want to, because they knew if I did get excluded, the likelihood is I would definitely end up getting involved in that world. But she used to do everything she could to sort of help engage me into the education process. But I just used to think, like, if I get an A in English or maths, that's not going to get me what I want in life, because all of these men that I see with all this money and wealth, they're not academically clever, but they're all incredibly wealthy.
Yeah, and you know what, I want to kind of loop back on what you said there about this idea that you were being told about this system and how, you know, yeah, all these people are sheep, and I guess that, you know, we're taking something from this system which oppresses you. And I suppose that feeling of maybe rebellion and power and control, and saying that, you know, it sounds to me anyway that there's that idea that, you know, I've heard you speak before about kind of, I guess, like a moral code around, you know, crime and actually when it was okay to, and who it was okay to commit crime to. So, for example, you know, not going out and robbing an old lady on the street because you're like, no, that's not cool, you know, but actually going to, you know, like you say, a system and saying, okay, we're going to take money from a bank, for example, is kind of fair game. And so I think it's kind of, yeah, it was very interesting hearing you say how those seeds were kind of planted, I suppose, to kind of incite that feeling in you to, like, an us and them between you and the system.
Yeah, definitely. And there was a very, very, very strong moral compass, like, in regards of that world and the rules and regulations of that world. Like, my stepdad always used to say to me when I was younger, the only thing you've got in the world is your name. And once you've destroyed that, you're gone in that world. Once people lose respect for you, they've lost respect for you. I didn't do what I was doing years ago. Like, I was never interested in being what you would class as, like, something like Goodfellas or a gangster. That didn't interest me. It was about the acquisition of money. And my stepdad always used to install that into me. You don't want people to be scared of you and stuff. Like, that's not what you do. You're not a gangster. We're not gangsters. We take from the system. And that was what the motivation was. Like, it wasn't about running around intimidating people. Like, if I would have ever have laid a finger or hurt a woman or a child, it just wouldn't have happened. Like it was instilled into me as a kid, and especially where my mum and my sister brought me up with my aunties. But in that world, like those, that the way that gets schooled into you, the rights and wrongs of your own moral compass.
So then talk me through what happens next. So you leave school, and then you, what happens next? You kind of go into that world, you know, they kind of take you under their wing and kind of teach you, I guess, about that life.
Yeah, like when I was at school, I was all, like I said, I was already truanting quite heavily. I'd never been in trouble with the police before, so I had no criminal record. But when I got to my 16th birthday and I was doing my GCSEs, my mum got really upset. She wanted me to do my GCSEs because she said, you need to leave school with some sort of form of qualification. And just to sort of make my mum happy, because she was getting really upset, I went and sat my GCSEs. I didn't do any coursework leading into them. I sat there, I did my exams. I went back to pick my GCSE results up. My head of year, Mr. Vickers, was there in the assembly hall. I was the last student to turn up. And I remember he had the envelope in his hand with all my qualifications in them. And he said, do you want to look at them or do you want me to tell you what you've got? And I was disinterested. I said, you tell me. And he opened them up. And I remember his face. He looked at me and he was just, he looked quite sad. Like he looked at me and he said, if only you would have applied yourself, John, what you could have done. Like he was disappointed. And he said that he couldn't believe I managed to get the grades I got considering I didn't do any coursework. Mm. And he said to me, what are you going to do now? And I said, I'm going to college. And I was just lying. And he said, are you sure you're doing that? And I said, yes. And then he gave me my qualifications and I ripped them up, chucked them in the bin at the end of the school drive. And I was in, like, that was me. I was going to be an armed robber. I went and bought a gun when I was 16 years old. And I say this a lot. It's perverse. And it just shows you how perverse that world is, that a grown man in his 40s would sell a child a firearm. But that's how ill that those people are, that they do that for money. And my stepdad found out, and he was then worried that I was obviously going to run around with this gun and kill myself or kill someone else. So he thought then it would be safe for me basically being with him and all of his friends. And then I used to go out and I used to look at security vans making deliveries to banks and building societies. And I had a really good memory. I used to memorize like routes of what vans made, what deliveries to what banks. And I'd pass that information on to older criminals. And then really, I realized when I was 17 that I wasn't going to get the money. I wasn't going to become a millionaire when I was 21 years old. But my stepdad used to say to me, do you think you'll be a millionaire when you're 21 like I was? And I realized I wasn't by doing what I was doing. So I thought, right, I'm going to start doing this myself. And basically, when I was 18, my stepdad got arrested by the Serious and Organized Crime Agency for conspiracy to commit armed robbery. The police were watching me. I was so arrogant. I thought I was cleverer than them. And then I ended up getting caught 2 weeks later for conspiracy to commit armed robbery. And really, this is where like the journey of me becoming an athlete really began, because I got arrested. I was held in an adult prison. So just so your listeners will understand, when you get arrested in the United Kingdom and you're under the age of 21, you cannot be kept with adult male prisoners because of child protection. So you have to be kept in something called a young offenders estate. So you should
be
kept.
You were 18 then? You were 18?
I was 18 at the time. So I should have been kept in a young offenders. But the Metropolitan Police believed I was a high escape risk because my stepdad and my uncle and all of the people that they thought I was connected to. So they did something that was very exceptional at the time. And they did something called starred me up, which meant they could then put me in an adult institution in a maximum security prison. And they made me a category A prisoner. So at the time, I think there was only 4 or 5 under 21-year-old category A prisoners in the country. And they moved me to a maximum security prison in Milton Keynes called Wood Hill. I was held in a segregation unit there. And then, because I was too young to go on the wing, and the governors didn't really know what to do with me. And then they come down and they said, look, we're going to put you on the wing with basically adult prisoners. Don't start messing around, don't fight, don't get yourself into any trouble. And then they put me on this wing, and I remember being on this wing with all these adults, and then suddenly you're getting all this praise from these like men that are in there for like drug trafficking and armed robbers, because I'm this like 18-year-old kid in their world, and they're like, what have you done, like how have you managed to get into this place and stuff at such a young age? And then it kind of like, I know it sounds quite bizarre, and it does to me now, but back then you're kind of getting all this kudos from these men that are like dangerous criminals, and they're all like lavishing this praise on you. And even the prison officers that were in the prison, like, I remember they used to call me Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, because they was even surprised that someone so young was in this male adult prison. And it kind of made me worse. Like, I remember, because it's like your ego, and you feel like, it's not that you feel important, but you just feel all this praise being lavished on you by these people. And again, like, I'm looking back now, and even just saying it to you, like, I can't believe that I was once like this. But I was. And I remember I went to the Old Bailey. I was looking at 16 years in prison. I was 18 years old. I got offered a plea bargain 4 days before my trial was about to begin, and they dropped loads of charges, and they wanted me to go guilty to lesser offences, which was possession of firearms, and I accepted it. And I went back to the Old Bailey to get sentenced, and Judge Goddard gave me 5 years. And I remember the Metropolitan Police that arrested me from the robbery squad were all in the court, and I was laughing because I'd worked the maths of it out. And by that point, I'd been on remand for a year, and I thought to myself, well, I'll be out of here in another year and a half, because I only serve half the sentence. And I was laughing at the police, and they were absolutely livid. And when the prison officers walked me back downstairs, they was like, I can't believe you've just laughed in their faces like that. And then they was even laughing. And then they took me back to Wood Hill. And when I got back to that maximum security prison, the governor come and saw me, and he said, John, we can't justify keeping you in this environment anymore, because your sentence doesn't warrant it. So we're going to downgrade you to basically like a category B prisoner, and that means you can be put back in a young offenders estate. And then they transferred me to Aylesbury Young Offenders. And yeah, like, this is where sort of the real next journey started of my sporting journey, really.
Yeah, well, because it's interesting when you were saying then around, oh, it sounds strange to say this, you know, now, but actually it doesn't, because, you know, it's human nature to enjoy that feeling, as you said, the spotlight or the praise or the status or the power. And so whether that's that, you know, being at school, whether that's with our peers, whether it's with the people we work with, or whether it's the people that you're, you know, in prison with, getting that status and that I guess spotlight, I think it's human nature, depending on your personality, to enjoy that feeling. And so it's no wonder, as you said, it made you, you know, in your words, it made you worse, because your ego then, I guess, is being fed. You're being like that pat on the back. So I guess, yeah, where did what this? I mean, honestly, when I said at the beginning that this story is fascinating, it genuinely feels like a film. You know, it feels like you're telling us the plot of a film. But what happens next? How? So you're young, I guess, as you said, you know, you're laughing at the police, you're feeling arrogant, you're still feeling confident. Yeah, what happened? What changed?
So I got moved to Aylesbury Young Offenders Estate, and I noticed the difference the moment I got off the prison van and walked through the reception area. So in the other prison, like, you're shown all this respect by the prison officers, calling me by my first name, by the prisoners. And then I then go to this young offenders estate, I get off the bus, so I go through the reception area, and off the bat, literally the moment you get off that van, they want to project their control over you. So now it's McAvoy, it's step off that line, don't look over there, look at me, answer this question. Now, what we haven't really gone into, and I know I said I didn't like the system, but I hated these people. Like, I from a young age, when I was spending more time with my stepdad, like I said before, a lot of projection of the stuff that they had gone through with the system and the state when they had gone to prison. Hating the police, hating the system, hating prison officers. So then suddenly when I'm in this environment, I didn't like the prison officers at Wood Hill, but when I got here, it was on another level of hate, because they were deliberately then trying to exert control over me. And like I said, my first name had gone, now it was my surname and my prison number. They told me I was going on this wing. They took me over the wing when I went through reception, put me in the cell. And then the next day the door opens and there was like between 7 to 8 prison officers standing outside my door. Two of them walk in and they demand that I took all my clothes off. And they said that because I'd been in a maximum security prison as a category A prisoner, they now believed, even though I was downgraded, I was still an escape risk of their prison. And they wanted to put me in a special yellow and blue suit, which meant when I walked around the prison, that all the prison officers could like identify me as someone to look at, because they thought I might try to escape. So it's basically like you're like a yellow canary walking around the wing and you stick out like a sore thumb on the cameras and stuff. So they asked me to strip naked. I wouldn't do it. Then they said to me, well, you're going to go down the segregation cell then. And that's what they did. They marched me down there. And then I went in front of the governor. And then when you're in prison, there's like they got their own rules and regulations. So I broke a rule by not complying with what a prison officer had asked me to do. So when I went in front of the governor, he gave me 7 days. It's called CC, confined to cell, which means you get put in a segregation cell for 7 days.
Is that like a solitude, like isolated?
Yeah, it's isolation. You get taken off a wing and you basically get locked up for 23 and a half hours a day. They let you out for 30 minutes to have exercise. And they put me in this cell. And at this point, obviously, you're in their world. You've lost control. So now I am in this yellow suit. And then when the 7 days was up, they said to me, you're going to go back on the wing and you're going to be a wing cleaner. And I said, that's not happening. I'm not working. I'm not cleaning up the wings. And they said, are you refusing another lawful order? And I said, I am. There's no way I'm being a wing cleaner. I'm not cleaning up your crap after you. And they put me back in front of the governor. And the governor sat at the table and he was looking at me. And he went to me, McAvoy, he went, remember this, you're in my world, I'm not in your world. I tell you what to do. And he went, so what I'm going to do now, I'm going to punish you again and put you back in that cell for 7 days, another 7 days confined to cell for refusing another lawful order. And then when you go on the wing, you're going to be a cleaner. And then they put me back in that cell and he smiled at me as I was walking out the room. And when you're in the segregation unit, they're not allowed to stop you from reading. And they used to give you 2 pieces of paper a week that you could write letters to people outside of prison and give you 2 second-class stamps. And when the librarian used to come around with a trolley, you was allowed to take books off. So they can't stop you from reading when you're in a segregation unit. And I took off a book and it was about Nelson Mandela. And there was a passage in the book when he was in prison that he used to smoke cigarettes. And he realized that the prison officers was using the fact that he smoked as something, as a punishment, as something to take away from him, the tobacco. So he never smoked a cigarette ever again because he relinquished it. They had no control over him. There was nothing they could take from him. And as a young kid, and I was 19 years old at that time, I thought to myself, well, if they think by putting me in this room, they're punishing me, I'll take the control away from them and I'll take the punishment out of their hands. And then I spent the next 365 days in that room, a full calendar year. I didn't know that's how long it was going to be when I made that decision. But after the 7 days, the second 7 days was up. But I needed to feel alive. And when I was in that room, obviously I didn't know when the ending was going to be. I knew I had a release date, so I knew eventually I was going to get out, but I didn't know when that was going to be. But I didn't know how long this journey was going to be by me being in this room for 24 hours a day.
So you chose to stay in that solitary confinement, that was your choice. You wanted to kind of take that, instead of it being a punishment, and say, actually, I'm going to stay here by choice.
Yes. And let, that you haven't got that control over me. If you think this is the worst you can do to me, I'll take it away from you. And that was where my journey of exercising began. Because like I said, like when I was a kid, I had no interest in sport whatsoever. I was a little bit overweight. But when I was in that room, I needed to feel alive. Like I needed to feel like I was a human being. And I started doing press ups, burpees, step ups, squat thrusts. And I didn't even know the name of them at the beginning. Like, again, I had no interest in sport or PE or exercise or fitness at all. But I just started moving my body. And I was, as I said, I was so unfit at the beginning. I was a little bit overweight. And I used to do like 10 press ups, 10 burpees, 10 squats. And then day on day, I just kept adding more and more repetitions to it. And by the end of that year, I would end up doing 1,000 of each exercise. And it made me feel like I was a human being. And when those prison officers used to look in that flap and looking to see what I was doing, I'd be in there exercising or sitting down, writing or reading. And I wanted to occupy my mind and my body. And I was just fueled by hate. That was what motivated me. It was absolute defiance. It was like, you can take control of everything off me, but you cannot control my body. And that was what motivated me. And honestly, even now, like sometimes when I really think back, like to the, because that is really where the journey started as me being an athlete begun. But yeah, the motivation for doing it was fueled by hatred. Like it wasn't fueled by like a passion to be good at something. It was like something that made me feel like I was a human being and I was alive. And this hatred towards the system. And that was what was that fire in my belly. Like, it wasn't going out and competing on my bike or going running or racing or getting aesthetic, like the aesthetics of getting a six pack and looking good because I was exercising so much. It took on a whole different meaning to me, exercise, when I was in that environment. And after that year, by that point, I'd served the 2.5 years. They opened up the door and they walked me down to that reception where I walked in, and they basically let me walk straight back out onto the street. And I was 100 times worse than the person they had locked up. I was even more determined. Like, I used to have a mantra when I was in there. And I used to say to me, every day I was in there, I said, this is not my life. These people have kidnapped me. And when I get out, I am going to get £1 million for every year they've put me in here for.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
John, there's so much in that. You know, it's so, I find it so fascinating. I talk on this podcast and in my book, you know, about self-discipline and about willpower. And, you know, on a very different scale, I personally am the kind of person who, when I say I'm going to do something, when I set my mind to it, whatever it is, big or small, I then know I'm going to do it. You know, I don't allow myself to listen to my own excuses, and I can be quite, you know, diligent, I suppose. But I've learned that willpower can be both a blessing and a curse sometimes, you know, kind of saying, right, I'm doing this, like, relentless no matter what. And, you know, I've heard you talk about those days, those 365 days, and saying that, yes, that was a choice. And that, I guess, through the repetition, through the exercise, through when people feel as though they are out of control, I suppose one thing you can do to assert control in one area of your life is to create a routine, to create repetition. So, for example, as you said, doing exercises, reading books. So, you know, before, gosh, there's so much in here, but I think channeling that motivation, and as you said, it was fueled by hatred. So again, blessing and a curse. Some people are motivated by proving other people wrong, or, you know, that chip on your shoulder that says, I'm going to show you, you know, what, for example, you didn't think I could do this, but I can. Or, as you said, sometimes people are motivated for other reasons, through performance, through accolades, through winning. But I guess back then, do you think that you always had that mindset, that driven kind of, if I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to stick to it? Or was it in that time, just being there, having that, I guess, dedicated time in that cell, did that start to change your mindset and kind of create this? Or has that always been a part of you?
No, I think it was always part of me. I think it all goes back to, like, when my mum told me my dad had died, because that woke something up inside me. Like, even when I was at primary school, I never thought like other people thought. I could tell, like, kids my age, I was always more of a deep thinker. When I was at school, I was only young, but I was always very inquisitive, and I just knew I wasn't the same, and that was my character. And then when I was put in those situations when I was older, it was the way I was, like the solitude, being on my own, being able to deal with that. Like, because I've come across lots of people that have been sort of in that situation, similar situation to me in those places, and it's cracked them. Like, they've been in there, and outside they're respected and people were scared of them, and they were powerful and they were strong and what they did, and they were strong men, physically strong men, and they ended up in a similar situation to me in one of those places, and they just fell apart, and they couldn't deal with it. Where I was in that environment, and I don't know, it was all this ability to be able to suffer, which later on in my life obviously was a massive attribute, but it was so detrimental to me in some regards when I was in that situation. Because I look back now, like, I look what I've done the last year of my life, and it's and I don't regret at all going through that situation. I regret what I did going in there. But if you said to me now I could go back and not go through that journey, I would still want to go through that journey. because I learned so much about myself and who I am as a person. But you can't, you still can't get away from the fact that as I was a 19-year-old young man, and I spent a whole calendar year locked in a 12-by-7-foot cage with very limited human contact. And that's, it's not healthy. And I look back on it and it does make me quite sad, because I look what I've done the last year of my life, and and I look at all the incredible things that I've got to experience, and how beautiful the world is. And it is such a waste of life, because I look at a lot of young men in those situations. Like, I'm blessed that I got out of that and I was able to turn my life around and do something else. But there's a lot of people that that is their existence. That is it. There is nothing else. Like, they will be in that environment for the rest of their lives, or sporadically in and out, but majority of their lives they'll be in there. And that's what I find quite sad, to think that it's those people, because I was able to leverage that situation. I woke up this gift in my body. I strengthened my mind from it, that allowed me later on in my life to allow me to compete in sport at a really high level, because I was able to draw on those life experiences that I've been through. And but unfortunately, a lot of people don't manage to do what I did, and that's what makes me quite sad.
Yeah, and I suppose that's what drives a lot of the work that you do now, right? And also, you mentioned then that ability to suffer, and how that later on in your life would be beneficial, you know, in your career as an endurance athlete. But I know that we're only, I suppose you being released after at that time, you know, that's only halfway, right, through your journey, through your story. So before we move on to, I suppose, the incredible achievements that you've done and becoming an endurance athlete, take us back. So you've been released, you've been in this cell, you've been working out, you've got this drive and this, you're still filled with hatred. You still want to, I guess, return to the world of the criminal world and go and become a millionaire. So John, tell us what happened next.
So I got released. Someone come and pick me up from the prison. And straight away, I'm back in the game. I'm already wanting to meet people, find out what's happening, what I can get involved with. And then also, where I'd been in that situation, people outside in that world, you become more elevated, because people know that you've gone in prison. And basically, you've not informed on your friends, you've not complied with the system, you've not been broken by it. And sort of you end up gaining more respect when you get out. I was out for 4 days. I found tracking devices on my car. I used to get my cars checked all the time when I got released, as often as I could. And within 4 days, I found tracking devices on my car. My friend was a car mechanic. And I took my car down to him for him to check the car over, and he found them under the back bumper. There was two of them. And then I knew the police were watching me straight away. So I thought, okay, I've got to be even more careful now, because I've only just got released. And I was playing a game with them for a month. I was pretending I was going to work every day, and I wasn't. I was just going to my friend's office and then sneaking out the back door, but leaving my car in his car park. And I was playing games with them. I was driving around London, sitting in traffic jams, and just like wasting their time in the day. And then I got fed up with that after a while, because I thought, I'm not just going to allow these people just to think that they can just follow me for as long as they want. So I took the trackers off my car. I had a solicitor in Hatton Garden. I went up there with them, took a picture next to a newspaper that was dated. And my solicitor, I said, I want to lodge a complaint against the Metropolitan Police for harassment. And he laughed and he said, look, if we write a letter to them, they're just going to come back and say, we neither confirm nor deny we've put them on the car. They probably not even got a warrant to put them on your car. He went, but let me tell you something now, John. He went, whatever you're doing, stop doing it. He went, because they are determined to put you back in prison. And I said, I'll be all right, Henry. And I took the trackers away, ripped them up, like dismantled them and chucked them in the River Thames. But again, I did have some sense, and I thought, he's probably right in regards of they're not going to stop until they catch me for something, or they're going to do something to make sure that I do, like they're going to put me in a situation where I end up getting arrested and get recalled. When I took the tracking devices off the car, they then knew, I knew they were watching me. Then the surveillance become more overt, and then I started seeing them, and I think they wanted me to see them. And then I had to make a decision, what do I do? And I had family that lived out in Spain. And then I remember talking to my uncle, because at that point he'd been released from prison. And he just said to me, look, you need to get out of Britain. You cannot live in that country, because they're just going to put you back in prison. And I did it. I literally, the day my license had expired, because when I got out of prison, I wasn't allowed to travel for 6 months. And then when that was done, I literally went out to Spain, and then I was going up to the Netherlands, and I was going down to Spain, and I was then living that lifestyle that you've probably seen in films and stuff. And I was just living a million miles an hour. Like, I was partying all the time. I was hanging out with criminals from across Europe, mixing with people that were multimillionaires, that legitimate business people that lived in the south of Spain. And again, it was all about wealth, the acquisition of wealth. My best mate come out, and me and him were living with each other. And I remember one night, me and him were sitting on a beach in the south of Spain, and we were looking out, and we were looking at all these like sun seekers, these boats in the ocean. And at that point, I thought that like we were mixing with these people that were so wealthy that I felt like we were going to go up to that next step. And I remember sitting with him, and I said, I think we're going to make it now. This is it. And he agreed. And I had this amazing bond with this man. Like, genuinely, I didn't have a brother, but I literally loved him like a brother. Like, I thought the world of him. Like, there wasn't many people I could spend a lot of time with, and he was one of the very few. And after about 6 or 7 months, I was coming back to the UK for a week because it was a friend of mine's birthday, and I was in two minds whether to come back or not, and I decided to come back. And I landed at Gatwick Airport, and my friend picked me up, and I bought a pay-as-you-go mobile phone from a phone, like it was like a car phone warehouse. And I gave my phone number to my friend that was in the car off the box. I didn't even put the phone on. And he said, where do you want to go? And I said, could you take me to my mum's? Because I've not seen my mum in quite some time. And he took me there. And I remember I was so tired because I'd been out partying the night before. And I went to my mum's and I put the phone on charge, went to sleep. And I woke up the next morning, the phone was ringing. And I thought it was my friend that I gave the number to, because he was the only person that I gave that number to. But it wasn't. It was one of my stepdad's old friends. And I was shocked how he got the number. And he said he went out last night and he saw my friend that picked me up. And he mentioned that I was back in the UK, and he gave him the number. And he said, can I come and see you? I said, yeah, of course. Yeah. And again, it was a man when I was growing up as a kid that I respected a lot. I looked up to. He come out of prison when I was 14 years old, and he was notorious in the criminal underworld in London and the UK. He tried to break out of prison 2 times. He'd been arrested for armed robbery like countless times and got acquittals. And he had this reputation within that criminal underworld where people really respected him. And he, like I said, he phoned me up and he said, can I meet you? And I went and met him. And I met him in this cafe and we were chatting. And he said, how's life been? And I said, yeah, it's good. And he said to me, do you want to go to work? Like, you still going to work? Meaning, am I still committing robberies? And I said, look, no, I'm not. I explained to him the situation about the police. And I said, look, like the police. And he was like, well, you've just got back from Spain. They're probably not going to know you're back in the country. And he said, look, I've got this bit of work, this robbery. It's really easy. Do you want to do it? And I, at the beginning, I was like, no. And then he said the sum of money, and the green mist come over my eyes. And I thought, do you know what? It's easy. I do it and then go back to back to Spain, and no one even know that it's me. And
oh gosh, John, I've got goosebumps listening to this, because it's those little moments, right? And you describe it in such detail, but it's those little moments where I'm thinking, okay, just say no, just say no, just say no. But yeah, so you said yes?
I said yes. And again, it's something I often say, it was the best decision I ever made in my life. What I didn't know, that when we were having that meeting, there was 100 police surveillance operation watching him, and they'd been watching him for months. Wow. And I just walked into this massive Metropolitan Police surveillance operation. I agreed to do it. I leave. I was very aware when I was back that I was very counter surveillance aware. So I didn't just like drive outside the cafe and then like walk back to my mum's and stuff. So I made sure that I walked through the park and I jumped over a fence, and I didn't know the police were watching us. I didn't know they were watching him at the time. But they end up basically tracking me. They found out who I was. I don't know. They took a picture of me, gone back to the police station and distributed it around, and someone recognized me. And then when they realised it was me, the whole operation just blew up massively, because then they knew they had two men convicted, that were both convicted armed criminals together. They'd been watching him for over a month. And they thought, this is it. We're game on. That we're going to nick him. Like, there's a conspiracy now. So then they found out where my mum's address was. Then they picked me up in the regards of the surveillance teams picked me up from there. And then 3 days later, we're waiting for a security van to make a delivery. And when I was in the car, the guy that I was with, Kevin, he got out the car and was in another car down the road. And when I was sitting there, we had walkie-talkies. And I remember, because we didn't have mobile phones, so they couldn't cell site us and they couldn't track the phones or anything. And I was on a walkie-talkie and I was looking in the rearview mirror and I saw... I just knew they were police. I knew instinctively they were police. I was at the beginning, I was parked down a cul-de-sac, and then I drove out the cul-de-sac and moved onto the high street when the van pulled up to make the delivery. And as I moved out that cul-de-sac and pulled up, I looked in the rearview mirror and I saw these three cars, like at high speed, shoot down this little road I was just parked down. And I could see that it was like four people in each car, and my gut, I had this gut feeling, and I knew they were police. And I was radioed to him and I said, it's on us. The police are here. It's on us. Do not do anything. And there was no response on the radio. And I drove off and I had this overwhelming sense of guilt that I was just going to leave him there. And I pulled over to the side of the road and I had one of these moments where I could have got out of the car and walked away, jumped over a couple of garden fences, and my mate lived a few miles away and the police wouldn't even have known I knew they were on me. Or I turn around and go back, and I had to go back. I couldn't leave him there. I felt too guilty. And I did a U-turn in the road to drive up towards where I was just parked a little bit further up. And I didn't see the police had moved out the cul-de-sac at this point. And now they were now on the high street. And now I'm driving directly towards them. And obviously they've panicked thinking he's going to see us. And then they've had to make a decision to ambush me. And then I just remember driving up this road, and it was in September and it was a sunny morning. And I just saw these three cars flying down the opposite side of the road. And I thought, it's ended. It's on me. And one of them pulled in front of me. One pulled by the side and one tried to block me from behind. But they left like a little gap. And I rammed the front car, drove up on the pavement. And I ended up having a car chase with them. They all jumped out the car at the beginning with guns. So now I know it's like, this is it. And I sort of drove up on the pavement, drove off. And I just had this voice in my head, like, I've got these three unmarked police cars with four men in each car chasing me with guns. And I just thought, I'm not going back to prison. It was like this voice in my head, because I knew what prison was like this time. Like, when I went there when I was younger, I didn't know what to expect. But this time, I knew I was going back to that segregation cell. I knew what prison was. And I honestly, I was fully prepared in that moment to die, to get away. I mean that. That's not an exaggeration. I was not going back to prison. And I had this car chase and I thought, I need to get out of this car before they get a police helicopter up. And I was driving through all these like little sort of estates. And I thought, I'm going to dump the car and just run. And as I got out of the car, they were really close behind me and they ran me. The car went up onto two wheels. I got out of the car. And then run off. And then I end up running into a dead end. And then I looked round and it was honestly like this tsunami of police officers running towards me. And there was one police officer in particular of all of them. And I just looked at him in his eyes and I honestly thought he was going to shoot me. His gun was up and he was screaming, get down on the floor. And I thought, he's going to shoot me. And I remember tensing up, waiting for him to just shoot. And thankfully, he didn't. And they dragged me to the floor and then they handcuffed me. And then it was the most deflated I've ever been in my life. I just remember just thinking, wow, like my life now, what is it going to end up becoming?
So that's it for part one of my interview with John. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned for Thursday this week when we'll release part two.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.